The Academy of Esports podcast is powered by LeagueSpot. LeagueSpot, your brand, your league, your way. Welcome to the Academy of Esports podcast. I'm your host, James O'Hagan, and this week I am with the co-founder and co-chairman of Beatball, Ryan Douglas. Ryan, thank you for being a guest on the Academy of Esports podcast today.
James, it is great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Now, Ryan, I'm going to give you a couple of questions here to kind of get us started. And I want to preface that these are kind of getting to know you questions, but we're going to transition a little bit into the work you're doing with Beatball. So you are about to enter an elevator, and the elevator opens up, and for whatever reason, there's a fog machine behind you as you enter this elevator. What song would you wish is playing in the elevator when you enter, walking onto that with me?
Stairway to Heaven. I mean, it's ironic.
All right, so a Zeppelin fan?
I am definitely a Zeppelin fan, but, you know, I mass genres, right? Like, I really like what's going on in electronica right now. Music has such a powerful, is a powerful medium to move people, and the folks that make it, I just love them. You know? And so I think that I can be in anything from sort of a chill mood and to house mood too. And I really like watching these genres that are blending at the moment. One of my favorite bands is a band called Moon Tricks, which I'm here in Canada at the moment at our place that we use mostly in the summer. And they're just sweeping through Canada at the moment. You've got a banjo with a DJ with, you know, like all these amazing vocals mixed up, but it's just feel, right? It's got a lot of really deep feel that gets to be sort of in a retrospective space. And I like that across the board in music.
I share your passion for looking at different kinds of music. It's funny too, my daughter who's 19, I find that I have influenced my daughter in some ways when it comes to her musical choices. We got to go see They Might Be Giants not long ago, but it was because They Might Be Giants, for a lot of kids now who are in their late teens, early 20s, grew up with Mickey Mouse Clubhouse, which They Might Be Giants did the songs, and they used to put all, you know, these fun kids songs on. And now these kids are coming back around to the catalog. But also my daughter sent me a song the other day, and it's an Irish harp song. Played from an album in the 1950s, and she goes, "Hey, this was sampled in a Passion Pit song." And I went, "What?" Nice. And it was I forgot off the top of my head which Passion Pit song it was, but I played the song and I went, "Oh my gosh, there it is." I thought it was just a just something that the group had done and put together as just something in the song, but they had taken this harp and this singing and sped it up and made it a higher pitch and put it into the back of the song. And that to me was, I'm going, okay, I've raised my kid right. So music, yes.
I mean, you get your old album, you get your albums, you know, from a family member, and they're this legacy sort of pass on thing. And there are things that we exchange from back and forth. I mean, right now I've been drawn deeply into the Flaming Lips and Odessa. They're folks that are working with Deepwell at the moment on some of the experiences we're building and going deep into their catalogs. You know, you're just like, you know, all you want to do is once you get a hold of these nuggets, you want to share them, and it's shared experience. And it really is kind of an amazing thing that you get between your children and your peers and that kind of stuff. I cannot say enough about music, the way it makes me feel, and just sort of the healing power of it, and the musicians as well. I mean, it's been kind of a lifelong passion of mine to play music.
And what's great too is, as kids are again, as my daughter's getting older, she's fine. You know, you try to say to these kids, well, you know, if it wasn't for this, you wouldn't have this today. And sometimes it takes them 20 years to go, oh, this music wasn't just created in a vacuum. The people who are making it now were influenced by X, Y, or Z. And it's funny how they are influenced by those things.
That is the legacy of media that I love, and of the artists that create it. They don't mind pointing to who it is that really influenced them and brought them along. You don't see that enough in tech or in med tech, where I was, where everybody's trying to really position their idea as the hottest, greatest, newest thing. But we're all standing on the shoulders of giants. I mean, it's the only way we get here. This is getting to be very complicated science. There's a lot going on, and there's no way that one person with one specialty can hit these multi-modalities. And there's no way that one person in one lifetime can become the specialist that we need them to be today without really, you know, absorbing other people's work.
There's this elevator that you have entered, and the smoke came through, and I'm standing in there. Stairway to Heaven by Led Zeppelin is playing, and you recognize me right away as somebody who is a potentially deep-pocketed investor. Yes, this person who was an educator for many years is all of a sudden a billionaire. Give me your 30-second pitch about DeepWell, your elevator pitch that a lot of people talk about.
So, I mean, DeepWell is exploring this really interesting phenomenon that we've seen in video games, which is a deep capability for video games to treat mental health. But ironically, it's those games that were not designed to treat mental health that have been wildly more efficacious and effective than any of those that have been purposely designed to do so. And so we spend a lot of time getting right down into the power of play. And what we have built is an infrastructure. Our job is to empower these creators, these developers that make these really amazing immersive experiences, to bring them knowledge so they understand which components of the game that they're building could have high therapeutic potential, help them enhance that. Also bring them knowledge about which portions of the secondary game mechanics outside of the play, the actual game, that could cause harm, what that harm could look like, what vulnerable populations might have to deal with in those environments, and really wrap that around a publishing structure where we help games get out into the world, and we want to get them OTC, so over-the-counter available, with FDA clearances so people understand what they can use them for and have good guidance on them, both including the fact that they maybe were already using it and aren't feeling like time is being wasted, or that they really haven't discovered a therapeutic answer for themselves, all the way to, you know, bringing them to a space where they can identify with the stress, anxiety, or depression, the symptoms that they're dealing with there, and where a video game can help. And we also do a lot of work to show you where you're maybe beyond a place where it's safe and smart to be using a video game, and it's time to be talking to a professional.
Well, Ryan, I know that a lot of people have seen, and I have seen, in fact, you and I have had conversations in the past about the claims that some people are making about their products, especially now that, and I think it's no secret to those of us who have been in it for a while, at least for me, you know, the power of play in general, but also the power of video games to connect intrinsically motivating ways to, in intrinsically motivating ways to not just children, but adults, senior citizens. I mean, heck, I've spent in the last couple of weeks about 90 hours playing Legend of Zelda. And that game has been the new one. I'm drawing a blank on it, but I spent about 90 hours playing it, intrinsically motivated. And I love the problem solving in it. And I love the things that are taking place with the dynamics of the open worldness of the game.
Yep.
But Ryan, you're not somebody who's just coming into this saying, oh, I'm going to start this company and we're going to make video games that are going to do X, Y, or Z, especially when it comes to, you're talking about medical games to promote betterment, better health, in real ways.
That's right.
Talk about a little bit about your background before, because I think your background is, when I think about, you know, people who come in and say, hey, I've got a health product they want to sell to a bunch of people, I look at their background and, you know, they're in their 20s and they got a degree in business, but they never actually operated in what it is that you're the medical field. So talk about it, because your history, your past, I think is just as important and interesting as the work you're doing now.
Yeah. And I think I'm going to start by saying I am wildly underqualified to create therapeutic video games. And I'll tell you why. I'm a medical device designer, therapy designer. That's what I've been doing for about 20 years. Before that, it was robotics, AI, when we were still calling it machine learning. I mean, this is kind of the world that I came from, and putting teams together that could take on big problems.
I love how you talk about putting your team together. So please go on. I want to make sure that that's actually talked about as to how you put your team together.
There's a whole other podcast on that, but we built that team around, you know, a deep sense of collaboration, belief, belonging in a system that doesn't run on mission, vision, values, or any one particular, you know, signal from the mountain on high. This was getting a whole bunch of amazing creators together, talking about their passions until we could find a common alignment and a purpose, and then, you know, taking that purpose out into the world. Interesting, we were a bunch of defense designers who had built robotics that saved lives and kept people from blowing up. And when the contract on our robots started to get a lot of traction with the military, they asked us to make it blow up. And the long and short of the story is we all shifted to making other things that help people. We were into health, wellness, and safety. That's where we thought technology could make a big difference, and we jumped in. So over 20 years, we commercialized over 20 medical devices, which is a thing. They were breakthrough therapies, all of which made it into the market, all of which had great accessibility to care. That meant that people could find them and they could afford them. And then we got an exit. In 2020, we had an opportunity to sell that company, and the majority of us that made that go landed in a place where, you know, there was a question of whether or not you have to work again. We're in a place where, you know, we've really made good a little early in our lives. And that gave me a chance to kind of sit back and reflect. While I was going through that acquisition process, it was very technical. The company was quite valuable at that point. I moved to Vancouver Island, where I am today talking to you. And I met a man named Mike Wilson. And he had founded a company and co-founded a company called Devolver Digital, which ended up being the world's largest independent game publisher. And he was in a similar place. He's on this island. We were here for many reasons, from political to just the fact that we needed to kind of get out of the way of our own organizations during this transition process. His company was going to go public. That wasn't where Mike was going. My company was, you know, evolving into, you know, a sort of a different space. And those of us that had founded it felt like it was a good transitional point for us. So Mike and I were kind of ended up thrust together by our peer network here on the island, because we mostly know younger folks. They are not independently wealthy, and we were driving people freaking crazy because we were available all the time. So they're kind of like, go hang out with Mike. Mike has time. And, you know, we spent some time together right through this really interesting introspective process of watching the thing you've created move out into the world without you. And Mike was really contemplating whether what he had done had mattered or whether it even had been harmful. We right in this time frame, we had just seen, you know, the World Health Organization and various entities were pushing forward the idea that video games themselves were a primary cause of disease, not necessarily a symptom of something. Which is still bantied around out there, but has been greatly disproven. At the same time, you know, the pandemic was starting to come on, and Mike's company, their last big release out the door while Mike was still there, was Fall Guys. And Fall Guys was just
fantastic game.
And it was doing this phenomenal thing, right? Where, you know, just as we're going into the pandemic and everybody's getting locked down, Mike's hearing of and they're seeing all these things that are saying, these games are they're sustaining me. They're keeping me in a place where I don't think without them I could be, you know, mentally healthy. And you've heard people say that about media before. We've heard that a lot about music, sometimes about movies as well, these things that we can emotionally attach to, as well as certain games like Dungeons and Dragons that become part of, you know, the community of an individual. So Mike is seeing this, and he's, you know, he knows that I have a medical device background, and you know, he's kind of pushing me a little bit with like, hey, you know, I think there's something here. And I'm like, yeah, you know, and I'd always been a fan. I was writing code from the time I was 12. I had a stand-up video game with 3,000 different games on it. We were the house that everybody came to play games. I believe there was a lot of intrinsic value in them, but they were games, you know, and I really didn't necessarily see too far beyond that. And you know, when you're a therapy designer, everybody's got a theory and they bring them to you. And I was a little bit like, well, let's play some tennis. But then you know, the study came out early 2020, Oxford. It was a meta-analysis of gaming and its potential for well-being. And it was, he handed me that one, and that sparked something for me.
Okay.
And I'll tell you what happened here. This is going back to what NextTurner really worked on. We were all about accessibility and cost. We believed if you were going to help somebody, that therapy had to be accessible. So we worked often to get the robotic solutions into the home. And the cost, we were always working on cost structures. So it was possible for people to pay for them, or if they're going through reimbursement, it's reasonable versus, you know, taking the money comes from somewhere, right? Is what I was saying. And so but there's a third component that makes any particular device, and I think any product viable. And that is, it has to have a compelling nature to it. So when you get the Venn diagram of something that is compelling, accessible and has costs that are in alignment with what is, you know, potential for the market, that's where you start to see real home runs. And as I was doing my introspection, I was a little worried about the part that we had played in building games, or sorry, building medical devices that had to do with being compelling. And the reason was, is that we had gotten these things out in the field. We'd passed a lot of clinicals, that kind of stuff, sold a lot of product. But if I'm being honest, the return rates on the products looked a little low. Like, you know, these had mechanical moving parts, and you're thinking, if this is treating someone's cystic fibrosis, or, you know, for a breast cancer survivor with lymphedema, for all these various things that we had looked at, you know, pain management sort of things, we're not seeing a lot in the repair centers. And I was getting a little concerned that they were in closets. Right. And that was kind of my, so when I saw the compelling nature and the potential for games, and then overlapping with, you know, a very credible study, and that very credible study, it also, you know, it had a teaser in it that there was thousands more of these studies that had, many of which had been started to kind of prove that video games weren't good for you, had found something counter to that, and oftentimes kind of pushed away to the side because the sponsors of the, or, you know, nobody knew what to do exactly with that study. And it was deeply embedded in academia, where, you know, you have these overlap between very prolific scientists who really love games. So was it being biased, all this kind of thing? And that started this journey up. So I said to Mike, yeah, okay, I mean, I'll look at this. I'll see. And so we were coming into the summer. My boys and I were here at the lodge, and it's a little isolated. And I said to them, what do you think if we take about 200 studies, we divide them up between all of us, and we're just going to rip through these things. We're going to do our own meta.
When you say boys, you're talking about the people with which are you talking family?
My kids. Yeah. I got three boys that are phenomenal. Two 19-year-olds who are on the spectrum, talented as all get out. A 15-year-old who's on his way to college here at the moment. They are great, great partners in crime, and they, you know, love and understand media and video games. And so it was really interesting. And they got that great skeptical mind that you can. And so we divided up and we ripped through 200 of these studies, and ended up actually between the four of us filing a patent around a core concept that we saw, and just went, oh my God, it's here. And it started as this concept, James, of therapy delivery. This is going to be a better way to deliver therapy. It's going to add that compelling nature to it. But as we got deeper into it, we saw them as the therapeutic as well. And that's where it got really interesting, right? It was like, okay, you know, we not only may have the very compelling nature of something that you can deliver or envelope a therapy in, but what if that play is in itself inherently therapeutic? 2.5 years later, that is exactly what we see to be true. And so that journey, you know, that my background all the way to here has led me to a place of coming to understand. And this is why I say I'm wildly underqualified to do this. It is the play is what we found more than anything. So DeepWell was founded to give these developers of games their just due, access to all of this regulatory support, quality support, you know, doctors, but to take a back seat to them and let them be in the control of the experience that's being developed. And I think that has been the fundamental problem with utilizing games therapeutically, is we found that you land in this place and they get so deferential. The game developers, they don't have a, you know, a couple of PhDs and business people right in their face telling them, you know, here's this construct, just gamify it. Like, okay, I'll do my best, you know, which is nowhere near the natural process of developing a game, finding fun, you know, getting that kernel of play involved, and then expanding it through, you know, a world. They have a process for this, you know, that got shortcut. But even when they were left to their own devices, they didn't see themselves as what I really see the game developers as, which is behavioral scientists. They have spent 40, 50 years figuring out how to compel the heck out of us. While doing it, they figured out how to get us really dopaminergic. And what we're just seeing now is when you're really dopaminergic, you can learn at accelerated rates. You can adopt new function, both cognitively, but also autonomically, right? So, and that comes through, you know, getting someone in a space of play, what we call dopamine with a serotonin chaser, something that is amazingly engaging in the moment and that you feel good about how you landed at it in the end. And that during those processes, you're not, you know, you're not susceptible to things as a vulnerable population that may not be great for you. And that's where that, you know, it kind of comes in. The gamification world, everybody's like, here, game designer, this is the thing. Here's the therapy. Mm-hmm. Now gamify it. You didn't allow them to run their process. You didn't allow them to interject their knowledge. And all you really gave them was secondary game mechanics when it was done, the scoring, the badging, the social, but they hadn't been able to create that great element of fun through a game, the play, put that into a gaming environment, do a really important process they call finding fun, which is often when you translate the really fun thing into the virtual environment, it starts as not very fun and they got to tease it back out to get the fun that was there before. And then they adorn it with the secondary game mechanics that are really designed to reinforce the play and the game, the action. So we built something where that process could live holistically, could manage in a regulated environment, which is very contrary to what the FDA wants. They want you to write code once, test it a whole bunch, and lock it down. And we found some ways to open that up so the game developer could do the game developing they're doing with a greater level of knowledge of what can be powerful, what can be harmful, and still really values the process they used to build the games in the first place.
Okay, first off, there is a lot here to unpack. And I hate using that word sometimes. I'm sorry, I couldn't think of a better word for it.
Yeah, I was on like minute 3 or 4 of the monologue going, okay.
But it's all great stuff because there's a few things there though that I wanna make sure we touch on because again, there's a lot of people, I think, flooding into this space, just like how a year ago there were people flooding into metaverse and there now it's and now everybody's flooding into AI. Flooding into mental health is has been kind of a steady drip, 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 I think, but is progressing more and more, especially as
the need is through the roof. And unfortunately, when you get that signal in the marketplace, it drives response, but maybe not always from the right people for the right reasons.
Precisely. And what I see right now, you brought up, and I think it's very important to talk about this because most people don't think about game design as a therapy, as a therapeutic. Not, as you said, you can not just deliver the therapy, but you could also deliver the therapeutic. And when you start using terms like that, and again, we have people who make claims that, use our app and it's going to help you, develop better memory, or use our app and we're going to help you lose weight or whatever. When you start talking about health related things, especially mental health and physical health, you're getting into potentially territory that I think some people don't understand exactly what they're getting into. Because when you start talking about medical claims, now you're getting on the FDA's radar. And I think, I talk about for years, I've talked about the snake oil salesman. And for those of you who don't know what a snake oil salesman is, basically, it was somebody in the late 1800s, a doctor, before regulation and everything else, a doctor would be going around country selling what basically was a tonic of some kind that could cure all ailments. My favorite one was those tonics that could cure your alcoholism and were like 50% alcohol. So, it is, I think, important that we talk about how your process about developing games with the idea that FDA regulation is going to be something that you are going to want to make sure that you are attentive to, because there are a lot of snake oil salesmen who are right now out there selling mental health products that may be only exacerbating the issues.
And I don't think so. Oftentimes when people get frustrated with the regulation that is in my industry, we had a saying, which is what came first, the snake oil salesman or the regulation. And the truth is to say snake oil salesman by a lot. There's a reason these agencies exist. Yes, they can be difficult to deal with. Sometimes they can be unreasonable. But for the most part, they really do keep people in a place of safety. And what they do is provide a ton of guidance. If you want to read and listen and understand, there is actually a lot of guidance out there on how to make a thing that is safe and effective for somebody and prove that you've done it right. And I think that's where those agencies get frustrated with folks, because they have spent, some people have spent lifetimes publishing and making it really clear what safe and effective means and what it means to make a claim and what you need to do to substantiate that claim. The other thing that's really important to understand, there's a few things to unpack here, James, just like you're saying back at you. The regulatory environment is not static. People think it's static, and you see this all the time, whether we're talking about, self-driving cars or how Uber, some consumer electronic company that's going to disrupt the health industry. It's like, look what we've done. You're like, yeah, that's great. And look, I mean, we found our ways around instead of through the regulation. No, you didn't. What you did is you bought yourself a little bit of time. Government moves slower. They observe. If you're on the fringe or on the line of whether or not they think they have authority, they tend to watch, but then they act. And that's why us talking right now, I think, is really important. There's been a series of things that have happened in response to all of what you're saying, the market kind of moving in a certain way at the moment, digital therapeutics getting a lot of traction, that traction being accelerated by the emergency order in COVID. And as a result of that, we saw a couple of things happen that are sort of monumental here in the last 6 months. Back in December, the FTC expanded its mandate beyond. So it had already in the 80s taken on the Nutraceutical Group. So the Nutraceutical Group had found a way to get around the FDA by making wellness.
What is nutraceutical?
Something you know, you take a thing, it's vitamins, it's minerals, it's butter and coffee, it's, you know, all these kind of things that are, you know, that make a wellness claim. They're going to get you better, but they're not really a drug. They're not regulated and often weren't tested. There was Herbalife, there was Amway got involved with various parts of it.
Gotcha.
So in the 80s, and they were getting around the FDA because they were not, FDA regulates what you say about a device and what you use it for. And so if you have a device and it's really for mental health, but you start saying, oh, this is going to help you with your low mood and lack of energy, you kind of walk out of their space. But the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, everything you advertise is their space. So in the 80s, they went, okay, look, enough is enough with this stuff. We've been seeing millions and millions to billions of dollars going to people. They're diverting their attention, time, and dollars to therapies that are, you know, to therapies or therapeutics that are not therapeutics and are not working. They're being taken advantage of. We're coming in to do something about that. So in the 80s, they came up with this set of guidances and rules, and they started regulating, and they regulated hard. The FTC is one of the most powerful agencies in the world. It's the FDA, everybody's like, oh, they're going to be hard to deal with. The FTC has insane amounts of power. Most people just settle as soon as they are approached by them. And
just for the audience, Ryan, I'm sorry, just for the audience, because we do have international people in the United States. We have the FDA, which is the federal, it's the Federal Drug Administration. Yep. And FTC, which is Federal Trade Commission.
That's right.
Okay.
FDA is all about things that you ingest in your body, health, wellness, you know, kind of stuff, from food all the way to drugs. FTC is anything you advertise. It's truth in advertising.
Okay.
And so in December, they expanded that doctrine they put together around, you know, really nutraceuticals and this sort of stuff for digital therapeutics and medical devices. And they got an agreement running with the FDA where the FDA said, you know what, we're going to manage the claims you make around your device, the point of sale advertising you do directly, and your relationship with the medical community. But we're turning all the rest of it over to the FTC. And so that means all of the grander advertising that everybody's doing is now being looked at through another lens on top of it, which is the FTC's. And they have a very stringent requirement. They don't care if you use the wellness term or the medical device term. They want you substantiated. And substantiated means that you have unequivocal proof that what you say your device or product is doing, it's actually doing it. Mm-hmm. So that in December, that all got expanded and their mandate, you know, changed in particular. And then we saw in April kind of some further expansion of those rules and guidances as far as what digital therapeutics could do, what it meant to make a claim, even outside of a medical device claim. And now the Surgeon General last week shows up, starts talking a lot about social media and how he believes there should be warning labels on it. This is, mm-hmm. Here comes the regulation, you know, coming in behind it. And so a lot of folks that have built a lot of things that may or may not have known they were doing it right or wrong. I'm not pointing fingers. I'm simply saying the landscape is changing, James, right now. And there's going to be a lot more accountability. And so the back-end systems that Deepwell built, that's what they do. They substantiate the claims. They manage a quality system for what and a way by which you communicate everything to do with the device and how the device is built in a way that the code is managed and contained. So we know what we're promising is what you're getting. And then we make sure that what we say is what we built. And we've built a very lean version of that we can use across media platforms because media is very powerful and we want to deliver it as medicine, but we have mm-hmm. to kind of the rules. What this means, now to add kind of the last point back to this, is those folks that have been making unsubstantiated claims, and those are broad claims, everything from shooting in games causes gun violence, all the way to, you know, loot boxes aren't harmful, or that I can get your memory to be three times as good if you do this thing, they're coming under a whole new scrutiny right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I know I sent you some examples and I was like, what do you think of these? And immediately you were like, problematic.
Yeah. I mean, unless they've got the literature and I went to their sites and they're not displaying it. So, I mean, the FTC moves quickly. They put out 680 notifications or warning letters since the beginning of the year. So they are not messing around. Wow. They're coming in for real, you know, and everybody, again, they get the letter, they hire an attorney, they think it's going to sort out easily and simply. But the truth is you're being drawn into this long process that's going to land you at a place of determining whether or not what you have claimed is real. Now, here's the really interesting part. And I like this about the FTC. If it is after the fact, you go run a clinical and you prove that you were telling the truth, they don't care. They're very clear about how it works. You do the clinical first. You have the substantiation first, or you have adulterated a product, period. The bottom line is either you have the substantiation when you made the claims or you don't. So that is going to come into this world in its entirety. We have this great merger going on. We are seeing media as powerful. The way we know something is powerful, as a therapy designer, I always look at the boundary conditions. On the boundary conditions of anything, if you find harm, right, that means doing it all the time or not doing it all, somewhere in the middle, you're going to find a therapeutic. And the question about whether or not it's a functional therapeutic is how much boundary condition there is from the harm to the good. So if you're talking about video games, we're finding a lot of boundary condition. There's harm, especially when you put the secondary game mechanics in there and you include things like social, or if you're trying to do them free to play and then you're trying to, you know, in-game selling, microtransactioning, loot boxing, all these things. But the games themselves, they have a pretty wide range of being therapeutic. Another example is fentanyl, right? None at all. You're in trouble if you're in a whole lot of pain. Tons of it, or not even that much of it, big thing. But the truth is, the margin for error is so that it's hard to use it as a therapeutic, except under really regulated situations. So we look for this boundary. Media has a lot of power. You know, it sounds silly, but with that power is going to come responsibility. But it also shifts considerably what the games can do, what media can do, how it's going to be ingested. And Mike, you know, Wilson from Devolver, my partner in this, started talking early on about media nutrition, and I loved that. It was the same way 20
media
years
nutrition,
ago.
What are we talking about here? Media nutrition.
20 years ago, we didn't really know what to eat. Definitely 30 years ago. I mean, people who investigated it understood, but your average Joe pulling up to McDonald's, the calories weren't posted. We didn't really understand the saturated versus unsaturated fats. We didn't know and didn't want to make, you know, maybe those decisions. Media is the same way. Over time, we're going to come to understand that it's as nuanced as food, that there isn't just good and bad. There's good and bad for various people under various conditions and various situations. And we're going to become much more aware of what it is we ingest and what the impact is, both positive and negative. And we're going to be able to curate it more and more for ourselves, for the situation we're in at the moment and for the trajectory we want to be on. If we do actually want to, you know, improve our memory, if we are dealing with mental health and where in the mental health cycle we're in, right? Two people depressed don't necessarily need the same thing. They certainly don't need the same game at the same time. One person might be dealing with a lot of anxiety. Another person might be dealing a lot with a loss. Video games can handle both of those things very, very well. Third person might be depressed because they're in a lot of pain. So a lot we can do about those things, but they're not the same thing. So if you use the wrong game there, like, you know, eating the wrong food at the wrong time, right, doesn't give you the desired result. And same thing we're going to be.
So with with DeepWell, in this, as you're doing things, I'll just say they're above board. Okay, you're taking the approach of, because you've navigated not just the FDA, but you've navigated patent offices, you've navigated making appropriate claims, again talking about the products that you've put out in the past, making sure that, I want to go back really quickly, because you talked about the part about the device advice is being in the closet. Like, you know, people buy them. And a lot of people do this. They buy something with the hope that it's going to make a difference in their life, and it ends up in the closet. How is Deepwell looking to, again, do everything above board, make sure that these are not in the closet? And what is your vision for how a video game, let's just say, from Deepwell, would be prescribed? Because again, it's not just the, and I know it's probably a very, very big question, but it's not just the doctor who now we have to have the conversation with, because doctors will prescribe things all the time. And then you get a call from your insurance company and says, well, we don't cover this much and we don't cover this and we don't cover that, but we're going to cover this and this. And it feels like a very impersonal conversation where a doctor who believes and knows you and seen you versus somebody who's calling you from a call center somewhere in the world is telling you, sorry, we're not going to give you this. It is a very screwy feeling. So how do we convince even insurance companies now that this is appropriate?
We don't right away. And that is one of the fundamental mistakes I've seen. And one of my frustrations with media's use in digital therapeutics at the moment, the build it and will come model. And this is the people that are Johnny come lately into my industry. And I get very frustrated here. When I talk about accessibility, that accessibility window, what you need to do is look at the market as it is today, think about its evolution over time, and build a product roadmap, not a one and done thing for a $1 billion moonshot, but the thing that works now in the present market that moves and elevates the conversation and understanding over time. So, you know, this is where I got really frustrated. Several large companies have either gone public, a couple have gone bankrupt, raising hundreds of millions of dollars. And one of their notable CEOs recently posted, did you know that you can have scientific evidence that something will benefit the mental health or physical health of a patient and payers won't pay? And my answer was, yeah, I do know. And so should have you before you took $140 million. This is the point that what we're doing at Deepwell is we're being realistic about where we are right now. There is a mental health emergency. There's not enough doctors to go around. The video games can work on symptoms of mild to moderate. We can take the load down by going over the counter and reaching people where they are around the world. And where 3 billion of them are is on gaming platforms, which means they're not ready to be deeply sophisticated medical devices. They're ready to do the work for the mild to moderate portion of the population and try to hold back the flood, the tide of more people that are coming down the path. If you want, and that's what Deepwell is really looking to do, you can build one that is for severe, you know, autism, severe mental health, but it needs a doctor, it needs to be prescribed, and it's going to cost a lot of dollars, and it's probably going to need to be reimbursed unless you build it so it can be low cost, right? And that's the point. This is not about the first one of us to make a $1 billion market cap. This is about looking at it and saying, we figured out by having the right regulatory systems in place and empowering the game developer that we could build games that we could sell for $20 or $30 or maximum of $50 one time, and they could have effect and benefit, right? And we would do it over the counter, and we will evolve over time. And I mean, and that it wasn't going to take one game. The other thing you see when these folks invest $50 million into a single game under this idea of driving it, you know, into the public markets as quickly as possible, they need that one game to be the silver bullet. The problem with that is that, like any piece of media, there is no silver bullet. I don't care. Pick your favorite game. You're not going to play it forever and always. To get you into that dopaminergic state, and this goes all the way back to your bigger question, how do we get you attracted? You're attracted because you're drawn to doing something and it's not perceived as good for you. We're not really built to longitudinally take care of ourselves. If something jumps out from behind you right now, James, you know what to do, right? You know, you're going to punch it in the nose, you're going to run away. And if you're more highly involved, you might punch it in the nose and run away. You know, especially at your size, I'd say two punches. And if we're handed something that longitudinally needs to be taken care of, like our children, we make oxytocin, our brain does certain things, we have certain neural pathways, and we start taking care of that baby. We nurture it, you know, and move it through its cycle. But we don't really have that pathway for ourselves, and we make ourselves feel bad about it. Athletes like you are wired differently than average on the bell curve. Most of us cannot find the motivation to do the things that we need to do. Are we bad people? Are we lazy? No. You have the privilege of neurological benefit that you get a certain spark to do a certain thing that other people don't get. So what the gaming does is it brings the spark, right? And that spark you know, if done appropriately, I mean, when Animal Crossing is making people feel better that are, you know, anxious, they weren't out to treat anxiety. They were just out to have a good time. And it turns out they did it in the right combination of ways, probably by mistake, but they still did that. You're getting therapeutic benefit without a ton of harm, right? Mm-hmm. And that's really what's available to us right now that we can do with the science we have, with the dollars we have. Everybody who's building a prescription game, I say go, but recognize that it's going to be years until you get reimbursement from someone who's actually gotten reimbursement before, right? I mean, it's not the first step of the product. So the first step, we get on the market, we start impacting change, we start doing something that is collectively valuable at a price point that makes sense, that's accessible. We keep studying, we empower an ecosystem where we're making enough of these. Then we put a package around that that becomes diagnostic, where we get a sense of what's a good game for James, what's a good game for Ryan. Around that time, when there's a community and a lot of folks that are managing the games appropriately, then you bundle that crap up and you get a prescription for it. And you put back-end engines on it so docs can use it. We're talking about a 10-year time horizon probably to make that happen, right? And if it comes from the place of not how do we moonshot this thing, but how do we solve a lot of problems for people in the present environment with the science and the regulatory and the technology we have today, the path becomes clear. And that's what accessibility is. It comes from a different intent from the beginning with the game, with the company. And DeepWell has that intent.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, but I want to make sure.
I go for a very long time. You have no choice. Well,
and it's not, here's the important thing also about DeepWell. And just touch on this. And I brought this back. I think I made mention about this at the start about the team that you put together. Mm-hmm. Because when we first talked, you talked about, and I loved the analogy, and I'm drawing a blank, but I know you're going to tell us about it. The band, right? The band in Memphis. Am I right? It was Memphis, and
it was Phil Spector's. Yeah,
you can kind of do this a little better than I can. So, don't just have a bunch of Johnny come latelys to this. You believe not in putting all. The best people together in the room to make this happen.
Mike Wilson is somebody that really has given a lot back to games. And so gaming gives a lot when he asks of it. And he whistled and folks came running to support it. So yeah, we're talking about some of the best game designers and operators. I mean, making a video game, everybody focuses on the game designer and stuff like that, but it takes a whole lot of infrastructure to put something like this together. And they all showed up, IT professionals, game designers, producers, the operation, the ops folks that, you know, make the whole back end work, all that kind of stuff. I reached out to the best people I knew in the neurological space, and we got some amazing folks like Dr. Sam Brown is our chief medical officer. He is a amazing pediatric neurosurgeon and a neuroscientist. You might know him, James, as the guy that invented the football helmet that prevents concussion and stuff like that. He invented a surgical suite for visioning neurological surgeries where, you know, uses augmented reality, and it really actually does versus buzzwordy. It makes doctors better. I mean, so we got, I mean, Lisa Marin, Dr. Lisa Marin joined our team. She built the psychology department at OHSU. I mean, we have amazing folks, and they all kind of converged on the idea. The concept that we came up with behind it was based on the story of Phil Spector's studio band. Really at the birth of American rock and roll at that time, we were new to electrified instruments and even playing our instruments this way and stuff like that. And there was sort of this teen craze towards a certain direction of the way the music was going to sound. And the potential producers were like, I love that. Like Richie Valens and even the Beach Boys and stuff like that. And Sonny and Cher, they're like, these guys got great ideas. But when they got in the studio, they weren't maybe amazing with their instruments. So they assembled this group called the Wrecking Crew. There's videos about this. If you liked it and it was American rock between the 50s to the 70s, probably they played on it. And, you know, and that's this. And we looked at this and then, you know, it got to be the place. There was generations of musicians like me. We listened to everybody playing. We're like, well, shit, I got to be able to play that. So you worked a lot harder on your instrument. And eventually the concept of studio musicianship on that level kind of faded away. But they were they didn't just play the music. It depended who you were. If you showed up and you were the Monkees, they were like, hey, go to the beach. We'll have an album for you by Thursday. And if it was, you know, if it was the Beach Boys with Brian Wilson, they would put 17 music in the room and play them like they were instruments, you know. So they were very adaptive. And that's what we've built, is this really adaptive team. If you're an amazing game developer and designer with an amazing concept, we're here to back you up and make sure the regulatory quality is there, show you the impact of what you're doing. If you're an amazing creative, but you've never really made a video game before, but the thing you're thinking seems to trip the trigger of what's going to work, well, we can really get right in there, make the nuts and bolts go. So yeah, the team is out of this world. You see some folks, Yen Wang has joined our team recently. We have David just came on, who previously led the team that did the interface for Ghost of Tsushima. I mean, these guys are playing on the highest level. Shahid, who has produced as many games as Mike has out of Europe and was a big part of getting indie into Sony, really even getting Devolver into Sony. These guys all, and women, just all packed in together to really, you know, work in service of this idea. And it's quite a team, and there's some pretty amazing folks to watch go.
As we are getting to the end of the conversation, Ryan, and I really appreciate your time that you have given, because I know you're a very busy man. But I have one last thing to ask, and especially because of the conversation we kind of had, and a theme going through all this has been about doing it the right way, about making claims that are accurate and true. Could you maybe summarize three things, like just three bullet points of, hey, I'm just a parent or I'm a kid, and there's something out there that all of a sudden I'm thinking like, oh, this is going to make me a better gamer or cure my mental health issues or whatever. What are like three things that people should always look for when they go to a website? Like, again, we talked about these examples, but like three things that maybe, or a couple of things that people should look for whenever they go to these websites and the claim. I mean, I feel like we shouldn't have to do this anymore, but we do.
Well, let me back up and first say, thank you for having me here as well. Every time we talk, I love it, James. I really appreciate what you're doing on social media. You're carrying forward a message that really matters. I feel really lucky to be here. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
There's kind of a, maybe I'll give you three things. First of all, when you're talking about video games, I'm going to give you three things to look for. This is not necessarily inclusive, but these things will work in their entirety. If you want a fast answer to whether or not something is probably safe for you to get engaged with and started with, one is going to be around its social media components. So as a parent, if there's free and unmoderated live chat or forums and stuff like that, it's probably not the right place to go for vulnerable populations right off the get-go. The game should have a beginning, middle, and end. And the energy dynamics should be such that they do not call you back in to preserve the work you've done, the money you spent, or the relationships you've built. Those are called energy dynamics. One company I've seen do an amazing job, it's Two God Games, and they're working on Destiny's Sword. If you keep playing for too long, you get fatigued in the game like you would in real life, and you're anymore in this sort of role-playing adventure. And like, that's a positive dynamic, right? Something that says, hey, chief, come back to your village, we need you now, flashes up in your phone in the middle of your day when you're trying to do other things. And if you don't show up, you let down your group, you lose your village, your coinage goes down. Those dynamics are going to catch you in a way that don't make sense. So that's kind of for games. Across the board for digital therapeutics, you're going to go to the website of the person that's selling this thing, and you're looking for their regulatory section. You're looking for their substantiation claims. If they claim that they're FDA cleared, the FDA has a list of all these games. If you can't find them, it's because they're not there. If you're like, no, nobody claims that their product is FDA cleared. Oh yeah, they do. Happens all the time.
Okay.
I've seen doctors put products in offices based on reps who said this is cleared by the FDA, and it's not. So there's places you can go to research it. But so I'd say the three major things when you're talking about taking care of your actual mental health: recommendations from other people, listening to what really worked for somebody. Then you go to the website, you look for their substantiation. Do they have, and the articles that they're posted, are they, I mean, do they overlap with the therapy that they're looking to do? You do not have to repeat someone else's study. You can be substantially equivalent. I do this all the time. I'm not going to waste time reproving a mechanism of action. If I can find 10 studies that show that this works, and I got them lined up, and I got my reasons why, done is done. So if they're substantiated, that's great. And it goes the other way too. Watch out for a clinical with 25 people in it and nothing else backing it up and no other studies around it. You know, it, I know it sounds like a lot of work, but it's a lot like, you know, it's buyer beware out there, you know. And then finally, if something is a medical device, it should be registered as such. And it's important to see that right away. If someone makes medical claims, which means they treat, mitigate, or diagnose disease, and you can't find them on the FDA, that's not a logistical error. There's lots of things they say, oh, I'm just waiting to be cleared. The rules are really clean and easy. First you get cleared, then you do the advertising. If you are going in reverse, then there should be a reason posted on their website, like they're under the, like DeepWell, under the COVID emergency order, they're pulling authorization. That works. Or, you know, there's lots of different ways to get cleared, but you should be seeing that someone is actually cleared.
Well, this conversation was definitely deep. I don't mean to say, okay, that was, I didn't mean to, like, we're talking about DeepWell. I didn't mean to say it was deep. It was deep. Well. It was very well. Yeah. Ryan Douglas.
Every now and then I talk about falling down
the DeepWell. I want to make sure people know too that coming up at the end of July, Ryan will be a keynote speaker at Games for Change in New York City. I am hoping to be there. Ryan, we got to talk about where we're staying.
And VR, VR Health in Amsterdam, I'll be talking there on the 29th, I believe, as well, opening up that one. That's an amazing conference where they're working a lot on VR is the conference, and the pain conference is running in parallel. Amazing things going on in pain with VR right now. That's not DeepWell work, but lots of people doing amazing things right now that really are for the right reasons. And those are the folks we want to shine the light on.
Well, Ryan, again, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for being a guest on the Academy of Esports podcast today.
That will do it for this week on the Academy of Esports. I've been your host, James O'Hagan. Esports are organized competitive video games, allowing schools to redefine their athletic culture, diversify opportunities for student participation, promote good physical and mental health, increase collegiate scholarship pathways, and play games. We can never forget the importance of play. The mission of the Academy of Esports is to support these ideals. The vision of the Academy of Esports is for all students to experience the fun and joy of playing competitive video games. You may follow me on Twitter at Jim O'Hagan. That's at JimOHAGAN. And through the Academy of Esports account at TAO Esports. It's a great way to get the latest blog posts, podcast episodes, and news coming out of esports and education. And remember, you can continue your engagement by going to www.taoesports.com. You can also connect through Facebook at www.facebook.com/TAO Esports. Thanks again for listening, and I look forward to our time again next week.